7. The gross market rate of interest as affected by deflation and credit contraction. We assume that in the course of a deflationary process, the whole amount by which the supply of money in the broader sense is reduced is taken from the loan market. Then, the loan market and the gross market rate of interest are affected at the very beginning of the process, at a moment at which the prices of commodities and services are not yet altered by the change going on in the money relation. We may, for instance, posit that a government aiming at deflation floats a loan and destroys the paper money borrowed. Such a procedure has been, in the last 200 years, adopted again and again. The idea was to raise, after a prolonged period of inflationary policy, the national monetary unit to its previous metallic parity. Of course, in most cases, the deflationary projects were soon abandoned, as their execution encountered increasing opposition and, moreover, heavily burdened the treasury. Or, we may assume that the banks, frightened by their adverse experience in the crisis brought about by credit expansion, are intent upon increasing the reserves held against their liabilities, and therefore restrict the amount of circulation credit. A third possibility would be that the crisis has resulted in the bankruptcy of banks, which granted circulation credit, and that the annihilation of the fiduciary media issued by these banks reduces the supply of credit on the loan market. In all these cases, a temporary tendency toward a rise in the gross market rate of interest ensues. Projects which would have appeared profitable before appear so no longer. A tendency develops toward a fall in the prices of factors of production, and later toward a fall in the prices of consumers' goods also. Business becomes slack. The deadlock ceases only when prices and wage rates are, by and large, adjusted to the new money relation. Then the loan market, too, adapts itself to the new state of affairs, and the gross market rate of interest is no longer disarranged by a shortage of money offered for advances. Thus, a cash-induced rise in the gross market rate of interest produces a temporary stagnation of business. Deflation and credit contraction, no less than inflation and credit expansion, are elements disarranging the smooth course of economic activities and sources of disturbance. However, it is a blunder to look upon deflation and contraction as if they were simply counterparts of inflation and expansion. Expansion produces first the illusory appearance of prosperity. It is extremely popular because it seems to make the majority, even everybody, more affluent. It has an enticing quality. A special moral effort is needed to stop it. On the other hand, contraction immediately produces conditions which everybody is ready to condemn as evil. Its unpopularity is even greater than the popularity of expansion. It creates violent opposition. Very soon, the political forces fighting it become irresistible. Fiat money inflation and cheap loans to the government convey additional funds to the treasury. Deflation depletes the treasury's vaults. Credit expansion is a boon for the banks. Contraction is a forfeiture. There is a temptation in inflation and expansion, and a repellent in deflation and contraction. But the dissimilarity between the two opposite modes of money and credit manipulation not only consists in the fact that while one of them is popular, the other is universally loathed. Deflation and contraction are less likely to spread havoc than inflation and expansion, not merely because they are only rarely resorted to. They are less disastrous also on account of their inherent effects. Expansion squanders scarce factors of production by malinvestment and overconsumption. If it once comes to an end, a tedious process of recovery is needed in order to wipe out the impoverishment it has left behind. But contraction produces neither malinvestment nor overconsumption. The temporary restriction in business activities that it engenders may by and large be offset by the drop in consumption on the part of the discharged wage earners and the owners of the material factors of production, the sales of which drop. No protracted scars are left. When the contraction comes to an end, the process of readjustment does not need to make good for losses caused by capital consumption. Deflation and credit restriction never played a noticeable role in economic history. The outstanding examples were provided by Great Britain's return, both after the wartime inflation of the Napoleonic Wars and after that of the First World War, to the pre-war gold parity of the sterling. In each case, Parliament and Cabinet adopted the deflationist policy without having weighed the pros and cons of the two methods open for a return to the gold standard. In the second decade of the 19th century, they could be exonerated, as at that time monetary theory had not yet clarified the problems involved. More than 100 years later, it was simply a display of inexcusable ignorance of economics, as well as of monetary history. Ignorance manifests itself also in the confusion of deflation and contraction, and of the process of readjustment into which every expansionist boom must lead. It depends on the institutional structure of the credit system which created the boom, whether or not the crisis brings about a restriction in the amount of fiduciary media. Such a restriction may occur when the crisis results in the bankruptcy of banks granting circulation credit, and the falling off is not counterpoised by a corresponding expansion on the part of the remaining banks. But it is not necessarily an attendant phenomenon of the Depression. It is beyond doubt that it has not appeared in the last 80 years in Europe, and that the extent to which it occurred in the United States under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 has been grossly exaggerated. The dearth of credit which marks the crisis is caused not by contraction, but by the abstention from further credit expansion. It hurts all enterprises, not only those which are doomed at any rate, but no less those whose business is sound and could flourish if appropriate credit were available. As the outstanding debts are not paid back, the banks lack the means to grant credits even to the most solid firms. The crisis becomes general and forces all branches of business and all firms to restrict the scope of their activities. But there is no means of avoiding these secondary consequences of the preceding boom. They are inevitable. As soon as the Depression appears, there is a general lament over deflation, and people clamor for a continuation of the expansionist policy. Now it is true that even with no restrictions in the supply of money proper and fiduciary media available, the Depression brings about a cash-induced tendency toward an increase in the purchasing power of the monetary unit. Every firm is intent upon increasing its cash holdings, and these endeavors affect the ratio between the supply of money in the broader sense and the demand for money in the broader sense for cash holding. This may be properly called deflation. But it is a serious blunder to believe that the fall in commodity prices is caused by this striving after greater cash holding. The causation is the other way round. Prices of the factors of production, both material and human, have reached an excessive height in the boom period. They must come down before business can become profitable again. The entrepreneurs enlarge their cash holding because they abstain from buying goods and hiring workers as long as the structure of prices and wages is not adjusted to the real state of the market data. Thus, any attempt of the government or the labor unions to prevent or to delay this adjustment merely prolongs the stagnation. Even economists often failed to comprehend this concatenation. They argued thus. The structure of prices as it developed in the boom was a product of the expansionist pressure. If the further increase in fiduciary media comes to an end, the upward movement of prices and wages must stop. But if there were no deflation, no drop in prices and wage rates could result. This reasoning would be correct if the inflationary pressure had not affected the loan market before it had exhausted its direct effects upon commodity prices. Let us assume that a government of an isolated country issues additional paper money in order to pay doles to the citizens of moderate income. The rise in commodity prices thus brought about would disarrange production. It would tend to shift production from the consumers' goods regularly bought by the non-subsidized groups of the nation to those which the subsidized groups are demanding. If the policy of subsidizing some groups in this way is later abandoned, the prices of the goods demanded by those formerly subsidized will drop, and the prices of the goods demanded by those formerly non-subsidized will rise more sharply. But there will be no tendency of the monetary unit's purchasing power to return to the state of the pre-inflation period. The structure of prices will be lastingly affected by the inflationary venture if the government does not withdraw from the market the additional quantity of paper money it has injected in the shape of subsidies. Conditions are different under a credit expansion which first affects the loan market. In this case, the inflationary effects are multiplied by the consequences of capital malinvestment and overconsumption. Overbidding one another in the struggle for a greater share in the limited supply of capital goods and labor, the entrepreneurs push prices to a height at which they can remain only as long as the credit expansion goes on at an accelerated pace. A sharp drop in the prices of all commodities and services is unavoidable as soon as the further inflow of additional fiduciary media stops. While the boom is in progress, there prevails a general tendency to buy as much as one can buy, because a further rise in prices is anticipated. In the Depression, on the other hand, people abstain from buying, because they expect that prices will continue to drop. The recovery and the return to normalcy can only begin when prices and wage rates are so low that a sufficient number of people assume that they will not drop still more. Therefore, the only means to shorten the period of bad business is to avoid any attempts to delay or to check the fall in prices and wage rates. Only when the recovery begins to take shape does the change in the money relation, as effected by the increase in the quantity of fiduciary media, begin to manifest itself in the structure of prices. The difference between credit expansion and simple inflation. In dealing with the consequences of credit expansion, we assume that the total amount of additional fiduciary media enters the market system via the loan markets as advances to business. All that has been predicated with regard to the effects of credit expansion refers to this condition. There are, however, instances in which the legal and technical methods of credit expansion are used for a procedure catalactically utterly different from genuine credit expansion. Political and institutional convenience sometimes makes it expedient for a government to take advantage of the facilities of banking as a substitute for issuing government fiat money. The Treasury borrows from the bank, and the bank provides the funds needed by issuing additional banknotes or crediting the government on a deposit account. Legally, the bank becomes the Treasury's creditor. In fact, the whole transaction amounts to fiat money inflation. The additional fiduciary media enter the market by way of the Treasury as payment for various items of government expenditure. It is this additional government demand that incites business to expand its activities. The issuance of these newly created fiat money sums does not directly interfere with the gross market rate of interest, whatever the rate of interest may be which the government pays to the bank. They affect the loan market and the gross market rate of interest, apart from the emergence of a positive price premium, only if a part of them reaches the loan market at a time at which their effects upon commodity prices and wage rates have not yet been consummated. Such were, for example, the conditions in the United States in the Second World War. Apart from the credit expansion policy which the administration had already adopted before the outbreak of the war, the government borrowed heavily from the commercial banks. This was technically credit expansion. Essentially, it was a substitute for the issuance of greenbacks. Even more complicated techniques were resorted to in many countries. Thus, for instance, the German Reich in the First World War sold bonds to the public. The Reichsbank financed these purchases by lending the greater part of the funds needed to the buyers against the same bonds as collateral. Apart from the fraction which the buyer contributed from his own funds, the role that the bank and the public played in the whole transaction was merely formal. Virtually, the additional banknotes were inconvertible paper money. It is important to pay heed to these facts in order not to confuse the consequences of credit expansion proper and those of government-made fiat money inflation. 8. The monetary or circulation credit theory of the trade cycle. The theory of the cyclical fluctuations of business as elaborated by the British currency school was in two respects unsatisfactory. First, it failed to recognize that circulation credit can be granted not only by the issue of banknotes in excess of the bank's holding of cash reserves, but also by creating bank deposits subject to check in excess of such reserves. Checkbook money, deposit currency. Consequently, it did not realize that deposits payable on demand can also be used as a device of credit expansion. This error is of little weight, as it can be easily amended. It is enough to stress the point that all that refers to credit expansion is valid for all varieties of credit expansion, no matter whether the additional fiduciary media are banknotes or deposits. However, the teachings of the currency school inspired British legislation designed to prevent the return of credit expansion booms and their necessary consequence, depressions, at a time when this fundamental defect was not yet unmasked. Peel's Act of 1844 and its imitations in other countries did not attain the end sought, and this failure shook the prestige of the currency school. The banking school triumphed undeservedly. The second shortcoming of the currency theory was more momentous. It restricted its reasoning to the problem of the external drain. It dealt only with a particular case, namely, credit expansion in one country only, while there is either no credit expansion or only credit expansion to a smaller extent in other areas. This was, by and large, sufficient to explain the British crisis of the first part of the 19th century. But it touched only the surface of the problem. The essential question was not raised at all. Nothing was done to clarify the consequences of a general expansion of credit not confined to a number of banks with a restricted clientele. The reciprocal relations between the supply of money in the broader sense and the rate of interest were not analyzed. The multifarious projects to lower or to abolish interest altogether by means of a banking reform were haughtily derided as quackery, but not critically dissected and refuted. The naive presumption of money's neutrality was tacitly ratified. Thus, a free hand was left to all futile attempts to interpret crises and business fluctuations by means of the theory of direct exchange. Many decades passed before the spell was broken. The hindrance that the monetary or circulation credit theory had to overcome was not merely theoretical error, but also political bias. Public opinion is prone to see in interest nothing but a merely institutional obstacle to the expansion of production. It does not realize that the discount of future goods as against present goods is a necessary and eternal category of human action, and cannot be abolished by bank manipulation. In the eyes of cranks and demagogues, interest is a product of the sinister machinations of rugged exploiters. The age-old disapprobation of interest has been fully revived by modern interventionism. It clings to the dogma that it is one of the foremost duties of good government to lower the rate of interest as far as possible, or to abolish it altogether. All present-day governments are fanatically committed to an easy money policy. As has been mentioned already, the British government has asserted that credit expansion has performed the miracle of turning a stone into bread. A chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has declared that final freedom from the domestic money market exists for every sovereign national state where there exists an institution which functions in the manner of a modern central bank, and whose currency is not convertible into gold or into some other commodity. Many governments, universities, and institutes of economic research lavishly subsidize publications whose main purpose is to praise the blessings of unbridled credit expansion and to slander all opponents as ill-intentioned advocates of the selfish interests of usurers. The wave-like movement affecting the economic system, the recurrence of periods of boom which are followed by periods of depression, is the unavoidable outcome of the attempts, repeated again and again, to lower the gross market rate of interest by means of credit expansion. There is no means of avoiding the final collapse of a boom brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as the result of a voluntary abandonment of further credit expansion, or later, as a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved. The only objection ever raised against the circulation credit theory is lame indeed. It has been asserted that the lowering of the gross market rate of interest below the height it would have reached on an unhampered loan market may appear not as the outcome of an intentional policy on the part of the banks or the monetary authorities, but as the unintentional effect of their conservatism. Faced with a situation which would, when left alone, result in a raise in the market rate, the banks refrain from altering the interest they charge on advances, and thus, willy-nilly, tumble into expansion. These assertions are unwarranted. But if we are prepared to admit their correctness for the sake of argument, they do not affect at all the essence of the monetary explanation of the trade cycle. It is of no concern what the particular conditions are that induce the banks to expand credit and to underbid the gross market rate of interest which the unhampered market would have determined. What counts is solely that the banks and the monetary authorities are guided by the idea that the height of interest rates, as the free loan market determines it, is an evil. That it is the objective of a good economic policy to lower it, and that credit expansion is an appropriate means of achieving this end without harm to anybody but parasitic moneylenders. It is this infatuation that causes them to embark upon ventures which must finally bring about the slump. If one takes these facts into consideration, one could be tempted to abstain from any discussion of the problems involved in the frame of the theory of the pure market economy, and to relegate it to the analysis of interventionism, the interference of government with the market phenomena. It is beyond doubt that credit expansion is one of the primary issues of interventionism. Nevertheless, the right place for the analysis of the problems involved is not in the theory of interventionism, but in that of the pure market economy. For the problem we have to deal with is essentially the relation between the supply of money and the rate of interest, a problem of which the consequences of credit expansion are only a particular instance. Everything that has been asserted with regard to credit expansion is equally valid with regard to the effects of any increase in the supply of money proper, as far as this additional supply reaches the loan market at an early stage of its inflow into the market system. If the additional quantity of money increases the quantity of money offered for loans at a time when commodity prices and wage rates have not yet been completely adjusted to the change in the money relation, the effects are no different from those of a credit expansion. In analyzing the problem of credit expansion, catalactics completes the structure of the theory of money and of interest. It implicitly demolishes the age-old errors concerning interest and explodes the fantastic plans to abolish interest by means of monetary or credit reform. What differentiates credit expansion from an increase in the supply of money, as it can appear in an economy employing only commodity money and no fiduciary media at all, is conditioned by divergences in the quantity of the increase and in the temporal sequence of its effects on the various parts of the market. Even a rapid increase in the production of the precious metals can never have the range which credit expansion can attain. The gold standard was an efficacious check upon credit expansion, as it forced the banks not to exceed certain limits in their expansionist ventures. The gold standard's own inflationary potentialities were kept within limits by the vicissitudes of gold mining. Moreover, only a part of the additional gold immediately increased the supply offered on the loan market. The greater part acted first upon commodity prices and wage rates, and affected the loan market only at a later stage of the inflationary process. However, the continuous increase in the quantity of commodity money exercised a steady expansionist pressure on the loan market. The gross market rate of interest was, in the course of the last centuries, continually subject to the impact of an inflow of additional money into the loan market. Of course, this pressure for the last 150 years in the Anglo-Saxon countries, and for the last 100 years in the countries of the European continent, was far exceeded by the effects of the synchronous development of circulation credit, as granted by the banks, apart from their, from time to time reiterated, straightforward endeavors to lower the gross market rate of interest by an intensified expansion of credit. Thus, three tendencies toward a lowering of the gross market rate of interest were operating at the same time and strengthening one another. One was the outgrowth of the steady increase in the quantity of commodity money. The second, the outgrowth of a spontaneous development of fiduciary media in banking operations. The third, the fruit of intentional anti-interest policies sponsored by the authorities and approved by public opinion. It is, of course, impossible to ascertain in a quantitative way the effect of their joint operation and the contribution of each of them. An answer to such a question can only be provided by historical understanding. What catalactic reasoning can show us is merely that a slight, although continuous, pressure on the gross market rate of interest, as originating from a continuous increase in the quantity of gold, and also from a slight increase in the quantity of fiduciary media, which is not overdone and intensified by purposeful easy money policy, can be counterpoised by the forces of readjustment and accommodation inherent in the market economy. The adaptability of business not purposely sabotaged by forces extraneous to the market is powerful enough to offset the effects which such slight disturbances of the loan market can possibly bring about. Statisticians have tried to investigate the long waves of business fluctuations with statistical methods. Such attempts are futile. The history of modern capitalism is a record of steady economic progress, again and again interrupted by feverish booms and their aftermath, depressions. It is generally possible to discern statistically these recurring oscillations from the general trend toward an increase in the amount of capital invested and the quantity of products turned out. It is impossible to discover any rhythmical fluctuation in the general trend itself.